The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we are analyzing the big stories from the world of technology, including the latest on Twitter. What does their heavy-handed action against two app services suggest about their future plans? And how does this tie in to talks of a takeover by web giants Facebook and Google? We'll also be looking at the future of content subscription services. Apple has announced a new model that's heavily in their financial favor. Google has countered with a much more developer-friendly option. How will the battle play out? Here to join the discussion is Jemima Kish, The Guardian's digital media correspondent. Welcome, Jemima.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm all right. How you doing?
Well, it is a heavy week of social media news here on the podcast, Jemima. And to continue the theme, there was recently headlines, almost silly season style headlines of an Egyptian man. You've got a big Cheshire Cat grin on your face. You know it's coming. An Egyptian man who named his child Facebook to say, thank you, Facebook, for being part of the revolution in Egypt. And my question to you today, Jemima.
Oh, no.
Yes. Is you already have a curiously named child.
Yes.
What would you name your second child if it had to be social media related?
Do you know that I think in a moment of sleep deprived, hormone induced insanity, it did actually cross my mind that I could insert Twitter as a middle name for my firstborn. And we didn't. He got an even better middle name in the end. But I don't know. It's an interesting sign of the times, I think. And perhaps in translation, it's a slightly more poetic name, maybe. Facebook. What?
Facebook. Maybe. No. Mm. I like the idea of Artly being Artly Twitter Kish.
Well,
Whipple Kish.
Yes. No, we stuck with Wolfgang, which is interesting enough.
The mind boggles. Well, finally this week, Charles Arthur will be rounding up the news from the Mobile World Congress conference in Barcelona. We will have the final headlines from that event later in the podcast, so keep listening to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Microblogging service Twitter has been in the headlines more than usual over the past fortnight, and not just because of its role in communicating about the people's revolutions in the Middle East, but for reasons a little bit closer to home. Jemima, last week, Twitter banned two third-party applications, Uber Twitter and TwitDroid, from using the APIs of the service, the sort of the back end, the technology behind the service. What happened here? What did they do?
Well, Twitter said that there were a few things that breached their terms of use. One of those was that some of the direct messages that these services were using, they'd occasionally go to tmi.me for messages that went over 140 characters, but that service would sometimes make direct messages public. Sorry, so that is obviously not
embarrassing.
Not a bit can be very embarrassing, and also it was the way that they'd used ads around tweets, so the way that they were commercializing it, which is very telling, and also they did not want them to use the word Twitter. So Uber Twitter has now been changed to Uber Social. Again, quite telling. Twitter initially put out a brief blog post saying that there had been some violations of terms of service. And then when pushed, they explained this in more detail.
And of course, but this is all kosher. This is, you know, this is part of their terms of service. So they're perfectly in their rights to call them up about this. Is this the media just going, ooh, Twitter, we need to find a bad story, or ooh,
well,
there's nothing bad happening?
Twitter said that actually they'd first brought these things to light in April last year, and that they had asked those to be rectified. So I suppose in Twitter's mind, you know, it was all very fair, but it was pretty harsh on the users because they didn't really give any notice. And Uber Twitter and the other apps that this company owns account for something like 20% of Twitter's traffic. So there's a lot of users and also a lot of celebrity users that were affected by this. So that's pretty lazy from a customer service point of view, I think.
And Twitter has traditionally been one of the more relaxed companies when it comes to people using their things. And, you know, that's helped to encourage encourage celebrities and various other people to use their service. So is this an indication? You said something interesting there, Jemima, when we were chatting before. You said it is telling that the advertising and the commercialization, is there heavy-handedness an indication of what they intend to do in the future, their business model.
Well, with every innovative company, and I think Twitter has been particularly open and quite laid back as well about how it develops its business, there comes a point where those investors and the people that have put a lot of money into the company need to start seeing it make money. And they have been a lot more laid back than most. Dick Costolo, the new chief executive who took over from Evan Williams a few months back, is more commercially focused, I think. And I think that he is driving this slightly more authoritative overview, this curation of the Twitter sphere, if you like. One thing that Uber Media were doing was this tweet-up idea, which was a bit like paid ads around certain keywords. And then I think a couple of days later, Twitter launched its own promoted tweets, which was basically exactly the same thing. So they are very carefully keeping an eye on this company that's quite aggressively rolling out commercial models around Twitter, because that's how they need to make their money. So it's kind of understandable. I mean, we'll talk about this later when we talk about Apple, but this is the payoff, if you like, for getting into bed with a company like this. If you want to play within their garden, then you have to play to their rules. And I think Twitter have been pretty relaxed so far. I don't think developers could really complain about their attitude, and they've been very, very open.
Steve Weiser on the blog said, Twitter want everyone to use their services, but if there's something better around, like Uber, Twitter, and Twitchdroid, then people will gravitate to those services. It's Twitter trying to manipulate market share. I fear TweetDeck will be next to suffer. How much do you think this is the case?
I don't think it's manipulating market share. I think what they're trying to do is they want to encourage these applications to exist, but they need to exist in a way that allows Twitter to take priority over claiming the money that's around that. And I think that's fair enough. Maybe I'm being too soft on Twitter, but, you know, it's their business. They created it. That's fair.
Exactly. So it's evolved from a service to a platform, yeah, ultimately. And you, yes, can see that spin-offs will be forthcoming. Mm. Interestingly, of course, there's also in the news that Twitter is being courted by Facebook and Google.
How much do Disaster!
How much do you think, first of all, how much do you think that they are starting to put their commercial ducks in a row in preparation for something like this, which would, you know, clearly give the investors back a nice hunk of cash for their investment?
It's hard to say whether they are preparing the company. I mean, it's never going to look bad if they look slightly more streamlined and if there is more clarity, I suppose, to their model, because people have been pushing for that and investors have been expecting that for some time now. I think I'd be surprised if they sold to Google or Facebook, and also a bit horrified and sort of a bit let down, I suppose.
Do you think
Google has the money?
Well, do you think actually that is the attitude of most users? Like,
yes.
Do you think there would be a diaspora to another microblogging style service if Facebook and Google? Because frankly, people don't seem to really care about.
Well, we
Facebook
care, obviously, because we're right in the thick of these things. But I think Google is a much more likely buyer than Facebook. I think there'll be too many monopoly concerns, basically. There'll be too much control if Facebook owned Twitter. God, the thought of it, though, is just horrible. It's the ethos of the companies is so different. Twitter is very, very open, and Facebook is almost entirely closed. And Google is just not right. I mean, they have the money.
They do no evil.
They do no. Well, they also do no social. It's going to be a whole HuffPo AOL thing all over again, and you know what I think about that.
Well, to find out what Jemima thinks about that, you can go to the blog guardian.co.uk/PDA. But speaking about buyout news, and this is slightly to the left of Twitter center, social game site Zynga is nearing a sale that's valued at $10 billion to mutual fund investors T. Rowe Price and also Fidelity Investments, amongst others. Now, okay, this deal isn't close to fixed, you know, it's in the pipeline, as they say. There's rumors afloating, and it might still fall through. But why Zynga? Why is Zynga suddenly valued as $10 billion?
Well, arguably, Zynga is where the money is in all this kind of social media stuff. there's a lot of interest and activity around social media, and the business models around that are starting to be refined but are a very long way off. But Zynga is capitalising on the growth and the vast networks that are created, and the user numbers. If you look at Zynga, 45 million people every day playing Farmville and Cityville and the other kind of sister games. That's absolutely phenomenal. But more than that, and this is why the investors are looking at them, they have multiple revenue streams that are producing a lot of cash. There's virtual goods and sponsorships as well, but they're also licensing merchandise and it's just at the beginning, and it's already quite phenomenal. So it's no surprise at all that fund investors are sniffing around.
And of course, $10 billion for that kind of package is if you think about the potential for growth, looking at other markets, looking at other areas. So, for example, in Korea, in Japan, in China, even where these types of states, where these types of varied and diversified markets around virtual goods and little games and this and that, the other. It makes complete sense, doesn't it?
And also, if you're an investor and you have, I don't know, you might have investments in mining and electrical supplies, kind of looks quite cool to have Zynga, and they probably have better parties, making a sweeping assumption about their hosting skills. But looking to the future, I think the expansion of sites like Zynga is really interesting as well, because Zynga obviously is very reliant on Facebook, but they're looking at expanding beyond that. So they may have games on Yahoo, for example, and they could expand in any number of ways, as well as introduce, I think, affiliate networks. So they'd have much more advertising, as well as the virtual goods and the other revenue streams they have. So in short, they're already making money and they're going to make a lot more.
It comes at a time of some really interesting investments. Groupon, for example, just raised $950 million. And, you know, Facebook was recently valued at an astonishing $50 billion, in part because of its recent relationship with Goldman Sachs. Now, why are we advancing towards a second bubble? You know, is Zynga going to be something that stands the test of time? Will Groupon be a passing fad, or will it become, you know, the next Craigslist or the next?
Groupon is a funny one, actually, because it's such a deceptively simple site. But I think the direction for that business is to go incredibly local. Quite how they make so much money, I don't quite know. It's a bit of a mystery. But in the bigger picture, investors are getting crazy about these companies because of the vast numbers of people that are using them, and they are assuming that when you have numbers at that scale, that has to translate into money at some point. And they've also bought this line from Facebook that the social graph is the next layer of the web. That said, I do think these are ridiculous sums of money, and it can't. I think the thing that will prove the validity of these as businesses will be when that bubble bursts, and then when the market reforms and kind of tidies up and all the kind of the fluff is knocked out in a few years' time, then we'll start seeing where the serious businesses really are.
Always an optimist, Jemima. It is actually interesting, though, that this does feel different from the last time. The last time was very much based upon the notion of eyeballs and advertising and, you know, getting people to come to landing sites and providing services, yes, but services that didn't really seem to be integrated into a social graph. Would you say, what's really different here about this next round of investment, that there is something that is in some ways tangibly different from the first time around?
Tangibly different as in people are definitely using it, and they're using it in a way that they are giving up an enormous amount of insight into themselves and their actions and their behaviours. And that is the future for online businesses. It's building businesses around actual behaviour and relevance and advertising. And Facebook has only just skimmed the surface of that now.
The horror. Just this
idea. But if you could have adverts served up to you that were relevant and interesting.
It's not just that. It's this whole idea of data-driven design drives me completely crazy. I think
where's the serendipity?
You lose that sort of the humanness. You lose that kind of squishiness.
That will all come later. I mean, this is part of the skill, and it's part of the process of development that, you know, you get the kind of mechanics out of the way, and then the interesting, more nuanced kind of human interactive level comes later, doesn't it?
But wasn't that what the social was supposed to be in the whole Web 2.0 phenomenon? Isn't this whole data-driven, graph-based content where they're scraping
our demographic? Are you challenging the principle of the social graph, Alex?
Yes, I am. Actually, frankly, I am. I studied it and I recognize the limitations.
I am quite optimistic. You know, give it a few years, it's all going to make sense.
All right. Well, we shall come back and have a gladiator-style battle in the future. But in other news, anti-competitive accusations, not like those that are happening here in this studio, anti-competitive accusations are flying around, and not just towards Twitter. Apple, a company not known for its open technology policy, has announced a new service that some traditional publishers fear will drain them dry. And that's, you know, including organizations such as The Guardian. Although no one has shouted foul yet, there are rumblings about the software giant, and the U.S. Federal Trade Commission is looking closely to see if the plans that Apple intends to roll out will breach antitrust rules. Now, Jemima, these plans center around the way the iTunes Store intends to serve up subscription services. So, for example, if you get the Guardian's iPhone app or iPad app, you buy it outright and then you sign up for a subscription. This is a kind of a model that's being bandied around at the minute. What is the policy that Apple is proposing so that they can make money long term, and why is this a problem?
In Steve Jobs' words, we've made it very simple. If Apple brings a new subscriber in to your app, you pay 30% commission to Apple. If a publisher brings in a new or existing subscriber, they get 100% of that subscription revenue, which is a very clever way of making it sound very fair. But of course, the App Store is a very important point of discovery for consumers. And if you have an app designed for the App Store, then it's very likely that most of your consumers are going to come through the App Store. And therefore, suddenly, whatever margin you might have made on that app, which is likely to be less than 30%, is going to be swallowed up by Apple's commission. And also, there is another clause that Apple says there can't be any links within your content to external places to get subscriptions. So basically, they have to come through the App Store.
And they've lined up, or they've laid out their potential threat, which is that if you do link within your service to other potential subscription outlets, then they'll remove you from their shelves.
Yeah, well, if we want to go through the things you can't do when you're on the Apple App Store list, I think we'll be here for quite a long time, but that is one of them. I think there's another, which is that the catalogue requirement for the amount of content that you have can't be over something like 3,500 articles, which could be quite interesting for companies that have very large catalogues that are accessible through their apps. But I think all of these factors are going to be ironed out as more and more companies explore this subscription system.
And it's not just words, right? You can see this rolling out into the future. At the moment, we're thinking about words, and we're thinking about, okay, you know, there are issues associated outside of the App Store when you're talking about paywalls for newspapers, like the other media groups that do that kind of thing. And you could see a future for this in audio, in video. At the moment, the most successful subscription service, the one that seems to have broken through for audio, is Spotify. How will a future of subscription, if you know, crystal ball gazing, Apple does decide that they want to create a subscription service for music, how would this affect other companies like Spotify?
I'm really not clear how this affects Spotify, because obviously they have a very distinct business model. It's what, something like £10 for a month for a Spotify subscription. And that, I can't imagine their margins are anywhere near 30%. So do they have to suddenly conform to this new subscription regime, or because they're an existing app, is that okay? Or because their existing subscribers perhaps come in more through Spotify as a desktop? It's very far from clear. It was interesting that Richard Jones from Last FM has already said Apple just fucked over music subscriptions for the iPhone. He was not very impressed at all by this. And I think with the feeling that a lot of very experimental music services are no longer going to have the incentive to experiment on the iPhone because there's no way they're going to be able to make any money. I mean, Apple's taken it before they've even started.
That could be potentially quite devastating.
It could be devastating. I mean, you...
Other outlets may pop up.
It seems harsh on content makers, whether they're news publishers or people selling music. But actually, developers have been paying 30% to Apple from the start, and nobody really complained about it then. They thought it was a good promotional platform, very high-profile way of getting apps to people, and 30% seemed a fair amount to pay. Then suddenly, when we're talking about very low-margin content businesses, that's outrageous, and Apple's got a monopoly. So we just need to decide collectively what we're prepared to pay.
It's about looking at the bigger picture. Well, part of that bigger picture are the competitors. And Google has announced OnePass, their OnePass subscription service, recently, which only demands a 10% commission on subscription services. So how do you think, Jemima, this is going to affect the whole chain of delivery? I mean, do you think this is going to have an effect on people buying iPhones versus Android-enabled phones?
Or? I don't think it will be a factor when people are deciding which handsets to buy. In terms of how those propositions are perceived by consumers, it seems like Google's always the sort of slightly square sibling of Apple. You know, it's sort of not quite as beautiful and a bit more clunky in its delivery. And that's partly because it's potentially a much more complicated proposition. So publishers, and this is a benefit, but also the thing that makes it harder for people to get their heads around, is that publishers can decide they can charge anything, you know, from 1 cent to, you know, 1,000, whatever they want.
That's $10.
yeah, maths. There's a publisher in Germany, their third biggest publisher, called Focus Online, who are experimenting charging 8 pence per article. I'm not sure how that works from a consumer proposition if you need to click agree on OnePass every time you're about to read a story, because clearly that isn't that exciting or enjoyable from a consumer point of view. But there has to be plurality. I mean, eventually we can only hope there will be more providers in this area. But the Apple thing, again, is just... it's that thing of getting into bed. You know, when you get into bed with Apple, you help make that bed with Apple, and, you know, you have to then sleep with them. That's kind of the arrangement.
You can't be a tease, is what you're saying.
You can't be a tease, no. You know, if you want to be on Apple, then you have to pay that commission. That's the deal.
And if you don't want to and you decide that there's a better potential partner in Google,
yeah,
because you don't have to pay so much.
Well, you may then have to make sure that the content you're selling through OnePass isn't cheaper than the content that you're selling through your Apple app, because I think that is another term of the Apple subscription agreement. Oh, God, who'd be trying to work out commercial models around publishing now?
Well, more on these stories and others at guardian.co.uk/technology. Last week, we reported on the biggest mobile conference in the world. Mobile World Congress, as it's appropriately known, is the king of handheld things, from handsets to apps to cases to services. But mobile, of course, means more than just phones. The Guardian's Charles Arthur was there looking around for interesting devices and interesting people who were doing something innovative and interesting with portable technology. Now, in a minute, Charles will be speaking with Stan Moe of MeeGo. Great name. Intel and Nokia's operating system that was planned for netbooks, tablets, and more. However, Nokia's recent announcement of a switch to Windows Phone 7 put the future of MeeGo in doubt. Hear what Stan has to say on this in a minute. But first, he spoke with Fraser Spears of Connected Flow, who's created a number of interesting Mac tools. He also happens to teach at a school that's moved its pupils onto iPads in the classroom. Fraser began by telling Charles why and how his school has transferred to the Apple device.
I work at Cedar School of Excellence, which is an independent school in Greenock in Scotland. And in August, when we opened, we gave every pupil an iPad.
How many pupils is that for?
We have 105, ages from 5 up to 17. So it's a straight through school, primary and secondary.
So this every child from the age of 5 has an iPad at school. And do they take it home as well, or is it simply at school?
Every pupil has one, and kids who are 10 years old and upwards will take them home.
What do they use them for? Do they replace all the books and other sorts of learning materials?
Books are a work in progress, I think. It's important to realise that because we're in Scotland, we have a separate curriculum from England, and it's a smaller market, and there's also a lot of change happening in the Scottish education system at the moment. So books are a kind of work in progress, but what we're particularly looking at is we're giving the kids a toolkit. So it's actually a lot to do with content creation and information exploration and things like that, rather than just it's an electronic book.
So we're here at Mobile World Congress, and obviously tablets are one of the big features here. You've been going around the stands looking at them. You've looked at the offerings from HP, from RIM, and we're here actually at the moment on the Samsung stand. Tell us what you think then first of the RIM, the playbook.
Well, I think from an education point of view, I mentioned we're trying to give it a toolkit. And a 7-inch tablet, I feel, I've looked at the 7-inch tablet from Samsung and the 7-inch from BlackBerry, and I think it's just too small a size to really be a solid creation tool the way that we've had experience with in the 10-inch tablets.
So as far as the interface goes, is that sufficient? It's more simply the size of the tablet?
I think the size is a massive limiting factor. We use applications like Pages and Keynote and all kinds of artwork applications, and it's hard to see how when you bring up a keyboard in some of these applications, you've not got a lot of screen left to actually do creation work in.
The next one you looked at was HP's, which they bought Palm last year for more than $1 billion, and they've got the WebOS version. So you looked at that. What did you think of that?
Yeah, they weren't letting Andy touch their tablet there, but from the demo that I saw, it looked very interesting. I thought in particular the way that they do multitasking on WebOS 2 is very interesting, particularly in a world where you want people to work with data from multiple sources and go from there to email and back to other applications. I think it's really quite powerful.
What was it particular that they did there that interested you?
Well, you can do things like when you bring up these cards that they have in the interface, every application kind of appears in a card, but you don't have to kind of go in a strict order. You can kind of push cards around and move them into other spaces. So if you're in the web browser and you want to go and compose an email and then move back to something else, on iOS, the way you do that is you kind of move between these applications. But WebOS breaks it up a little bit, so you can have your email inside the browser and so on, and the browser in another app and all that kind of thing.
It sort of has an idea of stacks, doesn't it, as well, where you can sort of say, well, I'm doing an email and it's also associated with this web page.
Exactly.
I'll stick them together and that's one task I'm doing, and then I'll go over to do something else, which is a gallery also while I'm working on a note.
Yeah, it's very fluid.
And finally, we're here on the Samsung stand, where Samsung is following the Galaxy Tab of last year, the 7-inch one. They've now got a 10-inch one running Honeycomb here on the stand. What's your impressions of that?
It's interesting. It looks a lot more like evolution than revolution compared to what they're doing with WebOS. And obviously, iOS is something we already know. It's interesting to see the changes. I've looked at the Galaxy Tab before, which is running the Android 2 operating system. I think my feeling with Android is I need to see the applications. You know, they've got a competent baseline of a browser and an email client, and they've got really good integration with Gmail, which we use at school, and also calendaring and so on. But I need to see some other things coming in, like a competitor to Keynote, a competitor to Pages, apps like Brushes and so on that we use very heavily. I need to see that I've got access to that quality of application as well from third parties. That's a big challenge.
And when you're talking about children using a computer, the thing that's important is the simplicity of the interface, the fact that you can't make mistakes easily. And how do these different the three different ones you've looked at here, how do they stack up against each other?
Well, I think time will tell on that. I'm skeptical of Android on the basis that they're selling it as a kind of open tinkering platform as well. And I think one of the big strengths of iOS in schools is that it is absolutely not that kind of platform. And in some ways, my experience has been that I only see an iPad come back to my desk when it's actually physically broken. Whereas with some of these more open devices, possibly I would see them back a lot more often just for configuration issues.
I'm here with Stan Mo, who is the Director of Strategy and Pathfinding for MIGO. Welcome, Stan. Tell us, what is MIGO?
MIGO is a Linux-based operating system environment that is designed for many different classes of platforms, set-top boxes, smartphones, netbooks, tablets, embedded applications, etc. It's based on Linux and a project that we had called Moblin from many years ago. We merged that project with a project that Nokia had going that was very similar to ours called MIMO to create the MIGO project.
Nokia announced last week that it is not going to be using MIGO as its future smartphone platform. What is your reaction to that? Does that mean that MIGO is dead?
By no means. I think certainly we're a bit disappointed in Nokia's announcement. I think that MIGO in and of itself, being an open source project, being managed by the Linux Foundation and having many contributors, which include Intel and Nokia, will continue on and will find its way in many different types of platforms and applications like you see here today. PRC, you know, obviously has in-vehicle infotainment that they'll be shipping and are shipping with MIGO. We have set-top boxes in Italy through Amino. We have netbooks. We have tablets. And the product portfolio will continue to grow and increase. So we see MIGO as a very vibrant, very active community of software developers and customers across many different platforms.
What is the thinking behind MIGO? What is it? What is the problem that it's designed to solve that we have in our existing computing needs?
You know, one thing we recognize as the market moved forward is that information, entertainment, communications continues to move at higher velocity. It comes at you faster. It comes at you throughout the day and throughout the night unless you shut every device in your home off. So we focused very much on three areas that we believed had very high density and very high velocity of information. One was media. The second was the internet, of course, which included communications. And the third was social networking. So we looked very closely at that as a key factor for the basis of the foundation of the architecture and said, how do we make that fast? How do we make that direct? And when you look at the user interface that MIGO has, both you know our own user interfaces as well as those of our customers, it's designed around being able to optimize that experience so that people can very directly to get at the information or at the experience they want, and that that experience comes at them in the most efficient possible way.
That was Charles Arthur at Mobile World Congress speaking with Stan Mo from MIGO. You can catch all of our Mobile World Congress coverage at guardian.co.uk/technology. Well, that's it for this week from me and Jemima. But before we go, Jemima, you wanted to say something about the Games Blog Live.
Yeah, event. I just wanted to say it was a massive success. We had three developers from EA and about 150 people, and it was a stonking success. So there's more on that on the blog, but we will be doing these again, so do keep posted.
Absolutely. Big applause to Keith Stewart for organising that. Many thanks to Charles Arthur for pounding the conference floor in Barcelona, and to Scott Cawley, our producer. We are back next week with more mobile news, but from India, and also a look at the trend in that country for mobile social networks. Until then, and thereafter, I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.